Writers, you may think you know Serena Bowen, but have you seen her in action? Do you get her emails, every one of which is a tight little package of joy custom made for her readers? Or follow her on Instagram or TikTok as @SerenaBowen, where you can watch her show up with even more perfect little morsels of marketing and will almost certainly end up finding a book that you'll love. If you don't, you should. Get all the links at serenabowen.com. Go ahead, we'll wait.
Is it recording?
Now it's recording.
Yay!
Go ahead.
This is the part where I stare blankly at the microphone. Try to remember what I'm supposed to be doing.
All right, let's start over.
Awkward pause.
I'm going to rustle some papers.
Okay.
Now 1, 2, 3. Okay.
Writers, I'm Jenny Nash, and this is the #AmWriting Podcast, the place where we talk about writing all the things, short things, long things, fiction, nonfiction, pitches, and proposals. Today, I'm talking to Jane Friedman, who is one of the most trusted voices in the world of publishing. She has advised and served organizations such as Writer's Digest, the Chicago Manual of Style, the Editorial Freelancers Association, the Alliance of Independent Authors, and the National Endowment for the Arts, among others. She writes 2 must-read newsletters for industry professionals. One is her personal newsletter, and the other is The Hot Sheet, where she provides nuanced market intelligence to thousands of authors and industry professionals. As we'll hear in this episode, that newsletter is getting a refresh and may have a new name by the time you're listening, but the content will no doubt still be timely, insightful, and critical for writers trying to understand what the heck is happening in publishing. The reason I wanted to speak with Jane on the podcast today is that she has just released an updated version of her book, The Business of Being a Writer, which digs into the nuts and bolts of the writing life, including the work of getting published and choosing how to do that, and the work of making money. It is one of those must-read books for writers who are serious about making a mark. Jane offers so much information, some tough love, and also reason for hope. I'm so excited to talk to Jane about her own writing process and her advice for writers. So let's get to it.
Hi, Jane, and welcome to the #AmWriting Podcast. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Jenny. Great to be here.
So I want to divide this conversation into 2 parts. And the first part is about the writing of the book itself. So the object, you as the writer, not your advice for writers, because this is a massive amount of work. The original of the business of, I'm saying the title wrong. I was going to say that I have a book title that's similar. This is The Business of Being a Writer. The original came out in 2018. It's now, we're talking in 2025. So much has changed. And you said in the intro to the book that you touched almost every paragraph of this 400-page manuscript. So can you talk about your process for doing that?
Well, my process was missing my deadline by about a year and a half. So, which I don't recommend. And I'm someone who hates missing a deadline, but that it was, I think it would have been easier to write the book from scratch. Honestly, I can't recommend doing second editions or third editions or fourth editions.
Yeah.
But you know, what I thought I was going to end up doing was kind of just going chapter by chapter and making some modest changes here and there, taking out outdated references, refreshing the examples. So it would have been easier to write a book from scratch than revise this book. I thought I was going to go through just methodically, chapter by chapter, refresh the examples, take out outdated information. But as I went through, I realized the way I think about the industry has changed, how I want to advise writers has changed. And so I ended up restructuring the book. I pulled out an entire part. I added 2 new parts. I mean, some of the information remains similar, but it's just been reconfigured and reconceptualized. And so it took a lot of time to figure out what I wanted to do with the book and what new framework I wanted to present.
So I'm curious about the missed deadline. Was that like a slippery slope, like a month, a month, a month, a month, or was it a really clean, I need another year?
at first, and I should say my editor was so gracious and never pressured me. At first, I said, I'm going to need another 3 to 6 months. And then that time passed, and I said, you know what? I really need an entire year and maybe a little extra. And at first, I didn't even want to put a deadline on myself because I was still wrestling with what direction the book should go in. But my editor made me commit to something rather than leaving it open-ended. And, you know, the goal was always to have the book release around AWP, which is typically in the spring or late winter. And so I decided, you know, if I'm going to have it come out in 2025, then I absolutely need to wrap this up essentially by fall 2024. And I did. So, but yeah, there were at least two conversations, if not three, about missing that deadline.
That's never fun. Yeah. Never fun. So did you have anyone assisting you on the research or the permissions or the compilation of all the bits and pieces? Because it's a very dense, data-heavy book, or was that all you?
Well, I already do reporting on the industry. As some of you know, I have a paid newsletter, and so I'm constantly exposed to research, data, interviews, case studies. And I'm continually making notes and filing things away for things I might want to change in that book. So that part wasn't necessarily a heavy lift. I'm always engaging with this information, and it's really top of mind for me. I did, however, have someone kind of go in behind me and clean up all of the footnotes and citations. And what I would consider the sort of stuff that you would have a research assistant do to make sure everything's in the proper format, that the links are still working, that all of it's, you know, in Chicago style, et cetera. But other than that, no, it was all me.
Yeah, that is a massive lift, a massive amount of work. You mentioned that the way you give advice to writers changed during your reconceptualization of the book. Can you talk about that? What changed?
Well, originally, the opening of the book was really in your face about the business. I mean, it was putting people right into the deep end of lead generation. You know, I think that might have been chapter 2 in the first edition, or at least in the first part. And I decided to pull back on that quite a bit. So that more hard edge business stuff is in the second half of the book now. And I start off with part 1 that I call Mindset Matters, because the longer I'm in the business, the more to me, what your mindset is really, it affects so much of your progress, whether you like it or not. And so I address those issues first. And then I segue into the part 2, which was not in the first edition, about platform. Mm-hmm. I don't like putting the platform up front like that, but it is such a top of mind concern for everyone. And there's so many bad ideas surrounding platform and what it is or what it requires that I felt like I had to address that immediately, how I see it, before anyone could really go on to like the marketing business piece. And especially since people are more concerned now with platform building before the book deal, before they even have a finished manuscript, I also felt like it was important to address that up front and how much of it is really, in fact, necessary.
Ooh, what will you share? What you think bad ideas that are shared about platform? You don't have to say yes, but I have to ask.
Well, the worst piece of it is it's about a social media following. How big, how many followers, what's your numbers, you know, all of this stuff that's really, you know, the dog chasing its tail. I think we lose sight of the fact that a lot of platform building is a result of the work that we actually have published and available for people to enjoy. It's about the stuff that you're doing out in the world. It's about your relationships. It's about how you have what Allison K. Williams calls your lived platform. I think people forget that they have one, and everyone has one, and people immediately look to online forms of platform and measurement and quantification. And that, to me, that's a good way to take all of the joy out of it very quickly, to make it feel like a burden, and like something you don't want to do. And so I'm really trying to get people to think about it in a different manner.
So I feel like your career is a beautiful example of that. You have a newsletter, you've dedicated, we have several of them. You've dedicated yourself to that over a very long period of time, very consistently. And you spend a lot of time, like boots on the ground at writing conferences, talking to writers, talking to the conference organizers, talking to your colleagues. And I wouldn't say networking per se, but just being in the world. And has that been conscious on your part, or is it just what you love to do? Like conscious as a platform building strategy?
Oh, it's very conscious. Yes. It benefits me. Like, it's very hard to do this job strictly from my home office. Like, there are things that people will not tell you, unfortunately, in forums like this. They will only tell you in person or privately. Like, you just get so much more out of people face to face. And I think this is especially true if you're talking with people inside the industry who tend to be more guarded. That's a whole other ball of wax that we probably don't need to go into, but I feel like it's hard to know what's happening in the industry without getting the vibes from the conferences and the in-person opportunities.
So besides your own newsletter and followers and network, what are you doing to promote this book this time that's different than in 2018?
So this year I decided to start a special newsletter, because I love email, that's devoted to how writers earn a living. And this is actually a lot of material that doesn't make it into the book. Some of the more nuts and bolts business lessons that apply to everyone, whether they're a writer or not, like negotiation skills or pricing. How, for instance, the one that's going to come out this Friday is about how status anxiety can torpedo your ability to run a good business because you're too concerned with what makes you look important rather than what actually would be good for your business. This afflicts writers a lot. Like, for example, I see writers who don't need an agent. They really want an agent because it confers status, or they really want a publicist because it confers status, or they want X because it confers status, without even thinking through, will this actually help me reach the goals that I have? So the email series, I've got about 3,000 people who joined that list, and it's supplemental to the book, and I'm going to be using that content in lots of ways in the future. And then, of course, there's the AWP piece, which I did with the first edition. I'm also actually having a book launch event. I did not have a book launch event for the first edition. At the time, I lived in Charlottesville, Virginia, and it was just not this is my own problem, but this was not a place where I felt like celebrating the launch of my book. But I'm now in Cincinnati, and there is a place that I really love and think is a perfect fit for the book launch. It's the Mercantile Library in downtown Cincinnati, so I've got a book launch event, and I'm also have some other things planned locally and regionally that will help me better celebrate the fact that there's a new edition out.
And do you have goals for this book launch in terms of numbers, or are you thinking of this book as a long tail sort of a thing?
I don't have any numbers tied to this at all. I am planning, let's say, I can't get into the details here, but I am planning what I would consider a brand realignment to coincide with the launch of the book. So I feel like, and I think a lot of other writers and business people struggle with this, you end up doing several different things and they all go by different names and they don't necessarily align, or you don't necessarily have everything pointing in the same direction. And what I'm going to do with the launch of this book is to get all of the ships rowing in the same direction again. And, you know, I'm sorry for being really vague about it. But I think in about 4 weeks' time, everyone will know exactly what I'm talking about, because you'll see evidence of it.
Well, this episode of this podcast will come out after that time. So we'll be to link to something so people can see what you're talking about. But I am going to read a quote that I pulled from the book on page 42 that goes to this. You said, "I use the word brand here to indicate strategic awareness about what type of work you're producing, how and where that work is being seen, and who is seeing it. Brand is about how you and your work are perceived. In a word, brand is expectation. What do readers expect from you? Like it or not, they will form expectations. You can wait and let it happen by accident, but it's better to consider how you can shape expectations yourself or decide when and how to work against expectations." So that, I loved that idea and sort of lessons for writers about how to be with their work or how to be in the world, as you're talking about, or how Allison talks about. And that so many of us have lots of different threads that we do. We might write different things or teach in different ways or different places, or like you have now three different emails, right? So that, what does it feel like? I'd like to just ask that to be out of alignment. Like, how did you know something needed to be done?
So I'm going to have to give some of this away, otherwise it will not make any sense. So the paid newsletter that I run, it's called The Hot Sheet. Now, this launched almost 10 years ago now. It is one of the longest running things I've done as an independent entrepreneur, freelancer, someone who's not traditionally employed. And when I launched it, it was in partnership with another person. As of 2019, I was the only person producing that newsletter, but I have still been running it basically as if it were a partnership. It is totally separate from everything else that I do. So I think just me describing that probably indicates there's something misaligned here, especially when my main website, which is janefriedman.com, that's what most people think of when they think of me. Not hard to see why. It's what gets most of the traffic. It's where people, like if someone wants to recommend my services or my knowledge or my newsletters, they're going to say, go to janefriedman.com. What I've found, and again, this is like not shocking, a lot of people don't even know that paid newsletter exists. And if they can remember it, they do not remember the name correctly. And it's not a good name. Okay. So the name has never been the best. You know, I'll just leave it there and you can anticipate what's coming.
I'm laughing because I've always wondered about the name of that newsletter. For those who don't know, whatever we're going to find out about it soon, the Hot Sheet is the industry's top place to go for breaking insider information on all things publishing. It is the place to go. And Jane has built it up to be that. So it'll be interesting to see what you're talking about. So the last question I want to ask about the book itself is, you decided to add action steps, I guess is what I would call them, at the end of a lot of sections where you're guiding people to actually go out and do things as an exercise, as a learning exercise about the industry. And some of them are sort of esoteric, and you're asking people to really dig into some places they might not have gone or seen or been to before. Can you talk about your decision to add that element?
The publisher, my editor said it was the biggest request they had received, primarily from the instructors and professors who use it in the classroom. They wanted to be able to, you know, give assignments or exercises to their students. And so my editor asked if I had anything like that. And of course I do. I have many things that from my classes and just from my general body of work that I've had people do. So it wasn't that hard to come up with exercises and various challenges at the end of those chapters. That was reader driven.
Interesting. Well, they're great. They're I wanted to go to them all, but I didn't yet, but I shall.
Some are time consuming, I have to say.
Yeah, they are. Well, the book does have I mentioned it's almost 400 pages, and it's dense in the best possible way. It's incredibly comprehensive, but to just sit down and read through the whole thing would take quite a lot of time. And to really, I did in fact read through the whole thing, but I'm imagining that most writers will dip in and out to the places that they are most concerned about at that time. Do you think that's how it will be used by the lay reader, not the classroom reader?
I would expect so, yes, because it's not every part is going to be pertinent. I think authors who are preparing to launch their book, like they just signed a deal, they're probably going to be looking at that. I think it's probably part three that has some really meaty chapters on launching your book, working with your publisher. And then there's some earlier chapters about if you're working on a project and you don't know whether should you traditionally publish, should you self-publish, you know, what are the pros and cons of those paths? You might go straight to that part. There is at the end of the book, and it's kind of, you know, anything you put at the end of the book, it's a risk. People are never actually going to look at it. And this is I wouldn't call it an afterthought, but it's very easy to ignore part six, which is about basically just some business fundamentals like forming an LLC, taxes, legal issues, contracts. I have a feeling that people might not look at that because they feel like they're not ready or they haven't. They don't really have a business per se, but I do put in the part introduction. Look, if you think you don't need this, you should absolutely read it because it's it's all the stuff that I left undone for way too long. I think most writers think it's, I don't know, hard or out of their wheelhouse or they're not earning enough money to even think about it. But I say, please at least glance at it because you could save yourself time, money, headache, mistakes, etc.
Well, I was going to save this conversation until the end of our conversation, but I think it goes really nicely with what you just said. You suffered, I don't know what one would call it, an online assault of somebody trying to steal your identity and people are fraudulently publishing books under your name, and a whole very public battle ensued and some legal things ensued, and some of that had to do with AI, some of it had to do just your stature in the business, but I don't know how much you can say about that or want to say about that, but is that part of the reason why you're saying to look at those kind of nitty-gritty business elements, whether you think you need to or not?
That actually didn't enter my head while I was doing that specific part of the book. However, because I had done all of those things already, it made it so much easier to tackle the identity fraud piece when it did come up, because I already had an LLC. I already had all of these things in place that... It gave me business standing to do what I needed to do. To kind of like speed through to the end game on that, what I did to help prevent these problems in the future was to file for trademark. And I don't actually talk about trademark. I don't think I talk about trademark in the business of being a writer, because I think most writers aren't going to end up doing that. But it's definitely something to consider if you have a brand that is in any way valuable or like a series. And I'm talking like big series, okay? Like Harry Potter or What to Expect When You're Expecting. And if you're working with a publisher, they'll certainly be looking at these issues on your behalf as well. But I think that there are a lot of complicated reasons in my situation why I decided to go that route, but it's not something I would have really been able to do, in my opinion, if I hadn't done all of the business basics first for years.
Yeah. How are you feeling about that whole situation now? I mean, I'm sure when it first happened, it was shocking and awful, but do you still... Like, how is it sitting with you now? What has it been, like a year maybe?
It's actually been, It's been 2 years. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I think.
Time flies.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, at the time, it was so frustrating. And it was frustrating mainly because of the difficulty of getting Amazon to take action. Now, I'm not the first author to be frustrated with Amazon. But, you know, it shows you the weaknesses of the systems we're using in publishing, and really more broadly than publishing, when it's so hard to fight right of publicity issues, IP issues related to AI. And there are certainly organizations, and our congressional representatives are supposed to be working on ways to better protect all sorts of artists and creators from their rights being infringed. And this goes so much further than copyright. You know, one of the reasons I had trouble getting Amazon to act is that this wasn't a copyright issue. It was a right of publicity issue. So there needs to be, of course, much more legal clarity around AI, period. But I think people are really overlooking the right of publicity issues that come into play as well.
That's interesting. And while we're talking about AI, where you and I are having this conversation in a week when there's been big AI news in the world, and just sort of the, for me anyway, I don't know, maybe I'm late to understanding this, but I finally realized that what's happening is sort of like the space race back in the day, who's going to be first to the moon. You know, it's a little bit like that, and it's global, and it's big forces and sort of frightening forces happening. Do you I mean, I'm sure it changes every day, but today, what are your thoughts about AI as it relates to our industry?
There are so many unknowns here. I almost hesitate to comment, but what I'll say is that there's going to be some form of AI licensing, like it or not. Like these companies are going to train on written work and images and all sorts of creative work, period. And we need to have licensing agreements in place that allow that to happen, you know, under some kind of systematic, procedural, like you can tell, is this legal or is this illegal, and who's getting paid for the use? So right now in the writing and publishing industry, probably the most talked about licensing platform is Created by Humans. This is the one that the Authors Guild has partnered with. And there, I think the other thing to keep in mind is there are also several types of licensing which you can say yes to or no to. Like, the point here is that the author or creator, IP holder, has the ability to say yes or no. But there are licenses for just training the models, which is like probably the training that most people think about when they think about AI models being trained. And then there is reference training or use, which is the technical term for this for AI is RAG model. So this is where when the AI actually gives you a citation for the information that it's giving to you, and it needs to have access to that information indefinitely in order to cite it. So there's also licensing for that. And then there's a third type of licensing that's emerging that's about transformative use. So this is where, you know, someone, let's say, creates a chat bot based on your work and sells access to that chat bot. Maybe you would like to do that as an author, or maybe your publisher would like to do it, you know. But at the very least, you should control how those rights are licensed or who uses them and get paid appropriately.
What do you think the best source of information for a writer to stay up to date or knowledgeable or learn about AI is? It's kind of hard to know who to listen to or
yes,
how much to know. What do you suggest? I think you have a news source you often recommend on Substack, right? Is that the place you would point people to?
There are like numerous Substacks out there on AI of varying qualities. I would say the first resource definitely is the Authors Guild, because they are writing frequently on the topic of AI. They have FAQs. Even if you're not a member, you have access to much of their like fundamental information that you should know, especially what What does AI licensing mean? What rights do you retain? How is that shared with the publisher, if at all? If you want the most intelligent, non-boosterish, I'll just say non-boosterish take, look for Simon Willison, and that's spelled W-I-L-L-I-S-O-N. This is a fellow based in the UK who, I want to say he comes from the tech side, but I don't consider him boosterish. He really understands on a tech basis what these models do, what they're capable of. And not all of what he writes will probably be understandable to you, but when he does write things that are for general consumption, you will be able to understand it. And he did a really great review of 2024 and what's coming for 2025 sometime in December of 2024. So go look for his year-end review, and that will be a good introduction to where we're at now, despite the fact that things change on a day-to-day basis.
That's great. A great recommendation. We'll link to that in the show notes. So I want to turn to the content of the book, and I pulled out three big takeaways for writers that to me really permeate all of the sections of the book and everything that you're talking about. And the first of those three is the idea, I mean, it's in the title. The name of the book is The Business of Being a Writer, but the idea that it's a business. This is a business. And some of the very first words of the book are these. You say, if you were a writer looking for the business education you never received, I hope this book provides the missing piece. So that that mission of business education for writers and the fact that so many writers are missing that or don't even think about that or even want to think about that and how much it's needed. I just wanted to talk about that a little bit. Why do you think this is so slow to change, that writers don't understand that this is a business?
I mean, there are several reasons. I think there's a continuing friction or tension between art and business. So it's not necessarily just the writers who have this problem. It can extend to other forms of art making as well. Although I have to say, I find that in the art world, they're much more open to the intersection of art and business. I don't know how to explain that. But I think there's, especially in the MFA community, the literary community, the people who are producing, let's say, literature with a capital L, or have very serious intentions, there can be this sense of, if you pay too much attention to the business, then you're selling out, or you're not a serious art maker if you're taking the market into consideration. I'm not saying that in this book that you need to pay attention to the market to decide how you write. It's that you have to pay attention to the market if you want to earn a living from what you write and publish. And so you pay attention to the market in the sense that how can you best monetize what it is that you have? Not everything can be monetized through sales. So you have to look at what are some other ways to monetize, whether that's patronage or advertising or something else. So I think that long time tension between art and business is at the root of a lot of it. And I think there's this prevailing myth, cultural myth, that the cream rises to the top, which is not true. It's, you know, when I was younger, I feel like I believed that. You feel like, oh, when if you're the best in the class, or if you're the most likely to succeed, if you're the most talented, someone will select you. You will be raised up. People will notice your greatness. And, you know, it's like there's some inevitability that great talent will lead to great success. And that's just not the case. So I'm hoping the book shakes people out of some of those beliefs, which are ultimately, I think, unproductive. Like, you could sit around your entire life waiting to be noticed or discovered. You have to put in some of your own effort to make this work on the business end.
Well, that actually bleeds into the second point that or takeaway that I found, which I labeled talent is not enough.
Yeah.
And you have some just incredible writing on this idea. And I want to just read one line about that. Well, you talked about writers considering this a business and learning how to approach the marketplace and how to earn money. And that there's a passage that ends with this line: writers who see this as a creative challenge rather than a brutal injustice are more likely to survive. So this idea that learning the business of being a writer is a creative undertaking. Is that how you've come to see it?
Absolutely. And I've been influenced by a range of people that have helped me, that have shaped my thinking on this. I would say if you look at, there's a book called Make Art, Make Money, which and the title tells you right away what that book is about. And that came out, I want to say, in 2012. And it's ultimately a biography of Jim Henson and how he made art make money. And it's very inspiring. Can't recommend it enough. And I think he saw it as a creative challenge. He took that tension and created the career that we all admire him for. If you look at one of my favorite authors, Alan de Botton, he wrote a book on, am I going to remember the title? How to Reform Capitalism, which it's a very slim book. It's probably not more than 20,000 words. You could read it maybe in an hour, in an evening. Totally worth it, where he looks at why do we suddenly get the ickies? Like, why do we get all flustered when we think about artists doing something that might be business savvy? And he really kind of unpacks that, where that comes from and how we can, as the title suggests, reform capitalism to be something that we're not so against, especially at this moment. You know, this is not the time to be celebrating capitalism. But I think he makes a very elegant argument for how it can be reformed. And I feel like that's what I am trying to do in my work on some level. And then there was another, I feel like there's a third that I'm going to blank on, but
yeah. Are you talking about the gift, the Lewis Hyde book?
Oh, that's another great one.
Is it called The Gift?
I'm
blanking on the title.
It is The Gift by Lewis Hyde. Yeah, that's a classic and well worth the read as well. Yeah.
Well, if you think of it, we can share it in the show notes later. So this idea that talent is not enough, I want to read another passage that goes to that idea. You write, being a published writer is not the incredible holy grail that people might think. You have to really want to do it to continue. And whatever self-doubt or anxieties you experience do not disappear once you publish. In fact, they tend to increase. The longer I'm in the business, the more I see it as intensely psychological. It's not a test of writing talent. It's a test of something else. But most of us tend to be obsessed with the talent part. So this idea that it's psychological, it's creative, the work of making your writing land in the marketplace and being part of the mix. And then, so it's creative, there's the business piece and it's psychological. Can you talk about that? I thought that was just a powerful way of pinning down what seems to cause writers the most angst. That they don't understand this part.
Yes, that actually made me think of the third person who is influential. Okay. Dana Gioia. I heard him speak when I was still a creative writing student. And for those who don't know, he was a vice president of Kraft Foods But he also has an MBA, but he also has an MFA in poetry, is a lifelong poet, and he became chairman of the NEA. Now, this has been quite some time ago, maybe even while I was a student or before I was a student. And so when he became the chairman, there were all these people who had trouble processing how someone could have an MBA and an MFA. How can you be a VP of Kraft Foods and a poet? And I thought he answered those questions so elegantly and powerfully. He said, well, once you become the CEO or an executive of a big company, you know, the work is intensely creative. You are making creative decisions in those positions. And I don't think most people have this stereotype of what MBAs or VPs are up to. And having been in corporate America, I agree that it is a creative challenge. It's not anyone who says it's about numbers. I don't think they're doing their job very well. It requires vision. And so I know I'm kind of going around your question, but I will get back to it. I want every writer to think about themselves as the CEO or as the executive running their business. And the challenge you have is a creative one. And of course, it's also a psychological one. I think we often, at least speaking for myself, I got wrapped up in this question of talent while I was a student and wanting the validation of professors. And I think people who don't pursue writing and publishing as a student, they can sometimes get wrapped up in validation from the agent or getting certain pieces accepted or getting a certain advance. But these external forms of validation, it's like having a sugar high. And it doesn't last long enough to keep you going for the amount of time it takes to accomplish some of the bigger goals that you might have, whatever they might be. I find that a lot of people aren't, in fact, honest about what they want out of the writing and publishing life. They get really distracted by some of these external validation pieces. And it is hard. I'm not saying that I'm not susceptible to it. Like, we are all susceptible to it. There is all of the status anxiety that goes into the writing and publishing life, the comparison traps, all of that. And to keep your eyes on your own paper is so challenging. And there's this temptation to do what other people are doing, whether it's for fear of missing out, that you're not keeping up, that you're going to look backward, you're going to miss out on success. And so it's very hard to hold on to your own vision throughout all of this, especially if other people are doing something different. And I want to say, as a little brag on myself, I held on to email when everyone said it was dead because I didn't believe them. And so it's just an example of holding on to what works for you, what you can sustain, what has value, what people respond to, without worrying about what the other, whomever these people are, they can be all sorts of different people, whoever the other thought leaders are, whoever the other successful people are, whatever it is they're saying you should do, always question it.
Well, you very nicely teed up the third concept I wanted to talk about, which is the idea. My little headline for myself was writers not knowing what they want and just not understanding what they can get from the industry, not identifying what their goals are or their purpose or their intention. And so there's this free floating, well, you just described it so well. These are the metrics I must adhere to if I don't really know for my own self why I'm doing this or what I want from this. So the question I want to ask is, when a writer has the impulse to write or they're called to write or they can't get it out of their head that this is what they're supposed to do or whatever that thing that draws us to this, and they've got that motivating force, and how do you suggest that they begin to define for themselves what they want? So the clarity that you were talking about, not adhering to the metrics of everybody else, like, oh, I need an agent and a book deal and a movie deal and a this and a that. Well, how do you find your desire or your intention as a writer?
I'm still figuring that out.
I mean, yeah, same. <It's>,
It requires so much self-awareness. And so it's kind of like trying to coach people into self-awareness. And I find that it's kind of like the old Buddhist technique of whacking someone with a stick until they achieve enlightenment. You know, there's just so many ways of whacking people with the stick to find out what they really think. Therapy is not a bad idea if you're able to afford it. Another shortcut is listening to Alan Watts lectures. He has a really great Bach series. Sounds True did a Bach series called Out of Your Mind, which is a fabulous progression. Because I do think it requires getting out of your mind. What I feel like the challenge is, if anyone's seen the movie Spirited Away, that wonderful Japanese movie, the animated movie. If you remember the bathhouse scene where Chihiro is trying to clean one of the spirits who comes in. It's a spirit that looks like a sludge monster, and the sludge monster gets into the bath, and she has to somehow, you know, clean him up. And she keeps pulling and pulling and pulling at like this thing that's trapped in him. And eventually what comes out is like this incredible, I don't even know what sort of spirit it is, but this like incredible flying white spirit comes shooting out. And I often think of that scene when I think of how writers are weighed down by years of other people's expectations or comparisons to other people who are successful or who knows what. But to get out of that layer of sludge, that's golden if you can do it. Another thing I often reference, another movie, this is Lost in Translation. There's a really great scene with Bill Murray where he says, you know, the more you know who you are and what you want, the less other people's expectations upset you, or their criticisms or their opinions. I can't remember the exact quote now, but I think that's so true. And so, yeah, I guess I've been rambling for a while now, but those are some starting points.
It's great rambling, though. And I mean, I think it points to the difficulty of that work of knowing what you want and how do you find it? And it, you know, you said you're still looking for it. I am still as well. And it goes to that, what you were talking about, your brand, just how you want to be in the world with your writing, how you want to be in the world with other people. And I think it just takes time in so many cases. I would suggest to our listeners, as a conclusion to this conversation with Jane Friedman, to get her book, The Business of Being Writer. I don't think there's any writer who can't benefit from this book, truly, whether you're just starting out, whether you've been in a long time, nonfiction, memoir, fiction, none of that matters. Poetry, short work, long work, any of it. It's really an essential guide. And there's a lot of facts in it. There's a lot of tough love. But I feel like it's ultimately hopeful to the work of writing and the business of being a writer. Do you feel hope, Jane, for where we are as an industry?
Oh, I've never lost hope. I always believe that writers can navigate it no matter what changes come, no matter what happens with AI. I've never felt like writers are in danger. Who knows about the industry? And on some level, I don't care what happens to the industry, because writers will survive regardless of what shape that it takes. But I mean, I think the message of the book, which you've so well reinforced, and I thank you for that, is that, of course, there's some amount of talent that goes into this. There's some amount of hard work that goes into this. But please don't forget the third leg of the stool, which is some amount of business savvy.
Well, thank you so much for joining us and sharing this. And I hope it's a long, long time before you do another revision.
I agree.
Thank you.
Thanks.
And for our listeners, keep your butt in the chair and your head in the game.
The Hashtag AmWriting podcast is produced by Andrew Perella. Our intro music, aptly titled Unemployed Monday, was written and played by Max Cohen. Andrew and Max were paid for their time and their creative output, because everyone deserves to be paid for their work.